This is another episode of the Welcome To podcast brought to you by the Land Information Access Association out of Traverse City, Michigan, bringing you innovative solutions for sustainable communities. I'm your host, community planner Zach Vega. Be sure to follow Welcome To on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, the Stitcher app, or however else you get your audio content, and go to liaa.org to see what else our nonprofit is working on. Hey everybody, funny story about the podcast this week. Here at LIA, we are working with some new equipment. I was really overambitious and didn't cross all my T's and dot all my I's before going down to Michigan State University here from Traverse City to talk to today's guest, Dr. Linda Nubani. And when you do that, sometimes you realize a half hour into the interview that you haven't reformatted your SD card and everything that you just recorded has now been erased. So in order to not have Linda sit there with me for 2 hours, I profusely apologized and we just gave the bullet point version of crime prevention through environmental design in about a half hour, a little bit less than that. So super big thank you to Linda for being willing to stick around through all of my technical snafus. And but on a more positive note, we now have a podcasting studio. We're working with new equipment. The sound quality should be better and it's really exciting. And so anyways, today's guest is Dr. Linda Nubani. She is a professor in the interior design major at the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at Michigan State University. Her work, which uses a lot of different measurement techniques, including virtual reality, mapping, and along with Holly Medill, specifically in the city of Lansing, they've been using design charrettes for a community engagement process, all focused on reducing crime through built environment improvements. This is great information, even if you're a safe community, whether you're a community maybe with a problem neighborhood or a problem intersection. Linda can tell you exactly what built environment features sort of help to deter or more negatively promote crime. And so her work is incredibly interesting. And I was really happy to have her on the podcast, even though I messed up so many times with the technology. For people who know me, I'm not the most tech savvy, and so this was not that surprising. But nonetheless, my apologies for the shorter episode this week, but I think all the bullet points are there, and I hope you enjoy it. Also, with the technology upgrades, we now have a better ability to make phone calls to guests, even though that's not what I prefer. I like to talk in person. The reason I mentioned that is that, I don't know if it's surprising. I'm surprised. I was expecting maybe four people to listen to this. It's mostly just my desire to talk to these people anyways, and I thought it'd be nice to record it. But we've seen that our listeners are in Michigan and in a lot of other states and some other countries. So with that in mind, if there are any planning topics or people that you know that would be really great to have on here because you think the information they have would be useful to a wider audience, please reach out to me at zvega@liaa.org. That's zvega@liaa.org. Otherwise, we're just going to keep going down my Rolodex of people, which isn't a bad thing, but there are a lot of people out there with good information in other states, and we want to cater to other people. But with that in mind, let's get into the episode, and I hope you guys enjoy. Bye. All right. So this will be a half hour episode because I didn't format the SD card. This is new information. So Linda and I are going to fly through SEPTED in the fastest.
Ooh.
All right, Linda, what's SEPTED? Crime prevention through environmental design.
Exactly. Thank you. Yep. I don't think we need this interview then.
All right. So SEPTED came from who?
Ray Jeffrey. He's a criminologist in the 1970s.
Okay.
He was the first guy to coin the phrase CEPTED, or crime prevention through environmental design.
And what's the idea?
The idea, since he was a criminologist, he was not an architect, he believed that through the effective use of environment or the design of physical environment can really reduce opportunities to commit crime.
Okay. And what are the guiding principles? It's so annoying that we've already talked about this.
That's all right. Between Jeffrey and Oscar Newman, the architect, maybe a couple of years in, a very renowned architect in New York City, he used the same concept, CEPTED, and published a book called Defensible Space. And that was pretty much the first book that has extensive guidance. Simply because he was an architect, so he was using his expertise and using the same concept of, well, what reduces crime and so on. So he based it on very, very basic ideas of surveillance, territoriality, and access management. Those were pretty much the first guiding principles of CEPTED.
And we'll rattle off quick definitions and examples of those. I apologize to the people who are listening to this that. We had some technical snafus, and Linda and I are both limited on time, so we're going to fly through this concept today. So surveillance?
So surveillance could be achieved through the use of lighting, mm-hmm. right? You do need lighting. You do need illumination to be able to see or detect a stranger's activity. But also, it could rely on line of sight. How much visibility do you really have outside your home and your retail store, and that could be achieved through different levels. It could be like if it's a house, for example, the availability of windows on a house, the orientation of the house, the size of the windows, the elevation and the cell height of the actual window are all very critical in maintaining a good line of sight from your living space or from the interior of the house to the outside. So if you're watching a movie, you're sitting on your sofa, and suddenly you stretch your arms and suddenly you look out and suddenly you see something, right? That's the basic idea of surveillance, or what we call it, natural surveillance. Now, mind you, some crimes like burglaries or home burglaries or breaking and entering, they mostly occur during daylight between 12 and 2 p.m.
Oh.
Yes.
Because people aren't home.
Sometimes people are at work.
Right.
Most people are at work. And then at night, what do you do? Of course, you do need lighting to illuminate those spots. And when we talk about lighting, there's so many considerations when it comes to lighting.
And LED is the best.
LED is the best. We already talked about that.
Because it doesn't create shadows.
That's correct, yeah. Zach.
I don't actually know this. I'm just recounting what we talked about for a half hour before we started this, this additional recording.
So there are different types of lights. It depends on where you use them. So the distribution is important, the type is important, the color rendition index or the CRI of the lighting fixture is also important because it gives you the true color of the light. So if you're using LED, which I'm a big advocate of, it really gives you the true color of like the car that just run away, or the color of the jacket that you're wearing, or even skin color. So with LED, it really gives you the true color. You don't mistake a blue car with a violet pink car. But in parking lots, that's really important, because if you use LED fixtures with the daylight color, that would really also eliminate shadows. So if you're going to your parking lot alone at night, you'll feel comfortable because you have really good visibility of the entire parking lot. Versus some kind of lighting, it generates shadows in between. You can easily, somebody could easily hide in the shadows. So those ones, I don't encourage their usage.
And then also with visibility, you had the 2-foot, 6-foot rule.
That's correct.
Shrubs and trees.
So yes, exactly. So we always encourage the use of low height shrubs under 2 feet. And if you have trees outside your house, try and leave trim the canopies with branches, and so they're like above 6 feet. That's really good because you can detect strangers, but also you can look out and make sure your children are okay and so on.
And then, so
let's say that that's surveillance, territoriality, basically the idea.
So defining your property, mm-hmm. really, could really be a very, very simple thing. It could be a symbolic gate. It could be,
painting.
It could be painting, or it could be defining the pathway onto your, from the sidewalk, the front sidewalk, all the way to the entrance of the house. So that kind of gives a gesture that if you're in my lawn, you're, this is kind of my area kind of thing. You don't really have to build walls. But if you do build walls, that's also territoriality. You can build them using, while maintaining good lines of sight. So if you want to build a wall to achieve that privacy, or because you have kids, you don't want them to run in the street, make sure that those walls are also below eye level. So your neighbors are always watching over your property while you're away, or even you're, at night. Or if you want to use fences, they could be like picket fences. So you see there's a gap in between. So this is what we encourage using. So all of these concepts are very, very common sense, and they're mm-hmm. really connected in one way or another.
Other examples of territoriality that you had, there was one that you gave in your presentation at Lansing that I thought was interesting, of just, having flower beds.
Oh, flower beds. Absolutely. It shows that you care as a neighbor. You care because those flowers look good. They're taken care of. You seasonal decorations. I also advocate those seasonal decorations because they show that, this neighborhood is, active around mm-hmm. different seasons, because if you have like lawn and you have flowers at all, you can't tell if you hired a third party company to take care of your lawn, which happens frequently. But let's say you threw some pumpkins outside your doorsteps around Halloween. That means you're there and you're celebrating those seasons, whether you believe them or not, or you go trick or treating. But it does show that a sign of occupancy. It does show that you're celebrating, and in the mind of a criminal, that means maybe I should not be targeting this house or the house next door, because the likelihood that they're going to report me is very, very, very high. So the risk gets higher with higher territorial concerns.
So I guess the basic concepts to sum that up is basically people should show that they care about their property.
Exactly, absolutely.
And they should have strong lines of sight from within their house to their neighbors, to the
absolutely.
Street.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
In your work, what's commonly a bad example of that? Because I know, so can you talk a little bit about what work you've done and how this has played out, not just from a research perspective, but how that research has actually informed recommendations that you've made to like the city of Lansing?
So we work closely with the city of Lansing, and we found a lot of really very simple examples that we believe are related to why those houses were selected as targets for crime. Some of the houses that we noticed had like very elevated, highly elevated windows. So if you're sitting in a sofa inside your house, there's no way that you're going to see out. Well, even though if you have window, that's one example. We've seen a lot of examples where overgrown shrubbery mm-hmm. is a big thing. It's simply camouflaging your window. So there's no way that you can see out. And, if someone's going into your house, your neighbor may not be able to report it or protect you. So those were some of the examples we've seen. In some establishments, if you want an example about retail stores, that surveillance could be achieved by making sure that the shop front is transparent, or at least clear off advertisement or posters that
right.
will obstruct visibility. So,
like a liquor store that has a ton of posters covering the windows.
For example, like,
not a good idea.
Yeah, and liquor stores are attractive because, they sell liquor and they have cash. And so you really want to make sure that employees are safe and you maintain that line of sight, can see out. And also it encourages more customers to get into your stores because they can see how your store looks like from, the moment they park, and they'll be more likely encouraged to come into your store and purchase products from you. So the same applies across all kind of establishments. So we've seen those examples now. Speaking of that specific example, the city of Grand Rapids have finally went accepted as in their ordinance, and they started with tobacco stores, liquor stores, and Lansing. Just I think Lansing is the second city in Michigan, if I'm not mistaken, that is going septity as an ordinance. I like to use the word septity. Mm-hmm. So they're enforcing septed, and basically if so one example is the removal of, you know, making sure that your shop front is transparent. There's a ratio, 80-20 ratio, that could be used. So you're allowed to cover a certain percentage of your shop front to advertise.
80% should be transparent.
80% should be really, it's a nice percentage, and it gives a very nice image about the store as well. You know, now, you know, as an architect, I believe that the aesthetically speaking, it looks nicer. I would be more encouraged as, you know, a customer to walk into a store that looks nice, psychologically speaking.
Right.
Simply because the products would be more appealing to you. So that's a nice percentage. And I think there are fines that will be being introduced as part of this ordinance. Grand Rapids started in August and Lansing just followed.
What built environment features have you found through your research that are highly related to incidents of crime?
Environments that are not septity.
Right. So, what's your nightmare environment?
Isolated, less eyes in the street. So going back again to Jane Jacobs' 1960s original idea of eyes in the street, which what led the work by Jeffrey and Oscar Newman mm-hmm. to do what they, you know, come up with their work in the 70s. So I think Jane Jacob was a pioneer about this idea, but then there has been, if you Google the difference between Jane Jacobs' ideas and Newman's ideas, you're going to find lots of debates about who's right and who's wrong. And in my perspective, they're both correct. Oscar Newman advocated for a separation between private zone and public zone. Jane Jacobs advocated for generating more eyes in the street to protect people from crime opportunities or reduce crime opportunities, simply because if there are more people in the street, you know, then I'm not, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not going to commit a crime in like yeah. with all of these yeah. eyes, right? So that was like a heated argument, you know, between the two. But you know, Zach, that I'm involved in work called Space Syntax. So it's another theory, also goes back to the 70s and 80s, and it's a theory that kind of measures accessibility in a different way. So it doesn't look at distances, but it measures accessibility in the sense of how many turns you make from one street to get to another street from all the streets in the system. So earlier we discussed cul-de-sacs. Are cul-de-sacs good? You know, there's some literature that talks about, Oscar Newman, he advocated for cul-de-sacs because they're private. So if you're in a main street and then that's a public area, and then you transition to a park off that street, that's a semi-public area, and then you go to a cul-de-sac with houses, so that's completely private. Then that's the separation that Oscar Newman called for. So that's kind of like opposite to what Jane Jacobs calls for, right? Eyes on the street, because mm-hmm. that's kind of isolation. But then Space Syntax comes in and says, well, it depends on where or how far off this cul-de-sac is from the street. So if you were way off, you were deeper in the system, or you were like, let's say you take 5 turns from your house in a cul-de-sac to get to the main road, then you're really, really isolated. Then there are really no eyes in the street in your area. But if you're closer to the main street, then most likely you're going to find neighbors jogging or exercising around the block than there would be if you're in an isolated area.
So
he does encourage also eyes on the street, but it depends on what kind of eyes on the street, whose eyes we're talking about here.
So, because this is the abbreviated version, the thing that I was most interested in talking to you about to see where your research has gone, because you helped a lot with my thesis where I measured different built environment features and how they correlated with social trust in neighborhoods in Saginaw. And you mapped out, so the way you mapped the space syntax, which I thought was interesting, and I didn't realize that you could do this, was you drew lines all across.
Right.
You've done this for the city of Lansing and then the city of Saginaw.
Right.
Where you literally drew the lines over every street there. And then for turns, it was sort of maybe
right.
one or
so
two lines.
Longest straight lines of sight, literally.
And I remember you saying that there are issues with having a very connected street in terms of like car theft?
Oh, so it depends on who lives in that block. Also, here's where social demographics play a role. So I wouldn't make the claim that space syntax or, you know, integrated street will predict less crime or more crime. Although there has been indications that where some scholars did find either direction, right? When I looked at it, I did find an interaction with levels of home ownership. How many people own, you know, the percentage of homeowners living in the block. So if they're an integrated area, then the amount of level, you know, the level of homeowners, because they're more stabilized on the street, then most likely they will be able to detect strangers from non-strangers. If you are living in a like 100% rental block or neighborhood, most likely you're going to suspect that the stranger is your next door neighbor who just moved in.
So like in a grid pattern, which is highly connected, it can be very safe if you've got high home ownership rates.
Of course,
rates,
definitely. You got it right.
But more dangerous, more prone to crime.
Exactly.
If not that way, a high renter.
It will
renter.
Be very difficult to detect strangers.
Because people can pass through very quickly.
All the time, yep.
And is that what you found that in Lansing?
Right.
So since I last talked to you, what have you learned about subsidy? Are there any new findings that you found?
We're now actually expanding on our work, because
so this started in the city of Lansing.
Of Lansing, and we recently received a grant, actually several grants that, you know, look at SEPTED. One of them is through EPSOR here, and we received a grant to look at three mid-sized communities in Michigan. And pretty much what we've done in Lansing, we're trying to repeat the same study in three different mid-sized communities and see if we receive, you know, the same results. And we're writing our recommendations based off our findings, hopefully this summer, which will become public. You know, we will posted on our website and so on. But we're looking at Howell, Albion, and Adrian, Michigan. We're using additional techniques. We're using, of course, placemaking. We didn't talk about placemaking. So we believe that, you know, generating activities and places will also generate eyes, the good eyes that you need in your community.
That's what I was going to ask is, so when you go to these communities, your planning process, it starts with the data gathering, right? So the space syntax measuring
is part of what we're doing right now.
In Lansing, which I'm assuming you'll probably do in the other communities, was you actually had mapped crimes. You made a crime heat map, and then you reach out to the community to confirm or
That's deny. Exactly what we're doing. Yeah, okay. Confirm or deny. And, you know, because sometimes you get, there's a big literature around whether, you know, some crime goes unreported because some people don't like to report crime. So you get that sort of discrepancy or, you know, dark figures and, you know, the crime data from police department does not match what how residents perceive it, per se.
Right.
Because not everybody, you know, I was robbed last week, for example, and I was very hesitant.
Were you really?
I was on vacation. I was robbed.
How many times have you been robbed, Linda? this happens all the time to you.
And I was like, should I report it? Is it worth it? Is it not worth it? And I debated in my head, is it worth my time? Is it not worth my time? I'm like, okay, well, you know what? I talk about SEPTED all the time. I think I should be reporting this. I think I should be generating a dot.
Yeah, from a data perspective
to make my data useful. Otherwise, if everybody's going to think that it's not worth my time, because it does take time to report something, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to survive. and I'm on vacation, so I'm like, nope, I guess I'm going to report it. So I did that. But, you know, a lot of people, they just don't report it. So the exercise that we've done with the residents, we gave them all maps and we've asked them to report where crime really happens. And we're about to launch a survey, you know, to reach more, even more residents than the ones that joined our workshops in last fall.
Yeah, that was a really interesting part of the Lansing planning process, was showing people a map of where the
map
crimes
were. It was very engaging, like that, too.
Yeah, and some people said, yes crime happens here.
Exactly.
Or, actually, I feel pretty safe here,
exactly,
but not here, where there was no crime.
And there were
mapping.
Lots of qualitative data around the, you know, crime dots that they put in the map. So it was really interesting.
So it's a combination of qualitative and quantitative.
Exactly. So
besides that, is what other data are you collecting as a part of this planning process?
So we started with... this new technique called the photo voice. Have you heard about that?
No.
Oh, yeah.
What is that? What is it called? Photo voice?
Photo voice, yeah. Oh. So we've asked them to do two things: to take a photo of the thing they appreciate the most, or the place that they appreciate the most, and the place that they appreciate the least in their neighborhood, and they have to narrate it. And
are you letting them define neighborhood?
In the neighborhood, in the city where they live. In the city. Most likely they will choose something they're familiar with in their neighborhood, but so we don't know.
I know you're working with Holly on this. Is this a charrette process that you're going to be doing?
The photo voice was, so we started with workshops on the photo voice, and there was a steering committee that was formed. They learned all about photography techniques and how to take the photo and you know, lighting and, you know, and composition and so on. And they were given examples. And I believe they will begin the process soon, between January and April. In April, we're going to have like a showcase.
Okay.
Yep.
So I know you got to go pretty soon. So I think the most valuable thing for the people who listen to this, because it's a community planning,
it is engaging
podcast, is mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that the planning process is really clear.
Right.
So you're going into the community. You've got you've identified your stakeholders. You've right. invited them out.
Right.
You're showing them. You're introducing them to the concepts of SEPTED,
right,
placemaking.
Correct. We did. Yeah.
You're showing them the data that you've collected, and then you have an engagement process where you're
right.
confirming that data.
Right.
You're getting qualitative answers to that
right.
through their pictures.
Right.
Through their mapping at tables,
exactly.
sitting around with their neighbors and drawing on maps. Is there anything I'm missing?
No, that's exactly, you captured it correctly.
And then what is the, what's the end deliverable that you get?
So
to
design recommendations for these different mid-sized communities. And while we were doing that, we received another grant like 3 weeks ago from Urban Collaborator and MSU Extension. And we're using that grant specifically to publish some kind of a visual guidebook around SEPTED.
Oh, cool.
It's like a resource. Most of the workshops we've had with residents from these different communities, including Lansing, they have all asked about a resource on how to achieve SEPTED. I think this will come in very, very handy, and I think it will be very appreciated by, you know, different communities. And that's where we're at. The visual guidebook, we will engage also residents to confirm. We'll have different workshops, so it could be very, very informative, very useful, easy to read, easy to understand as well.
Do you think there's ever been a more exciting time to talk about, people have ever been more excited about how the built environment affects our social ties and the way that we behave and how we feel? It just seems like this is like a brand new, or people are just now, you know, you said this research has been out since the 70s, but it seems like just now people are really catching on to the importance.
Realizing that it's really, really important. I never understand why suddenly SEPTED became a buzzword recently. And sometimes when I talk about SEPTED, people are surprised that it goes back all the way to the 70s. Mm-hmm. What happened in the past 40 years? Why? I'm not sure what really happened. I don't have the answer to that. Again, I say that, you know, SEPTED is very simple, but I did see, I'm not sure if it was a TEDx talk by Frank Abagnale. I don't know if you have heard. Have you seen the movie Catch Me If You Can?
No.
Leonardo DiCaprio. It's a very, very famous movie. It doesn't really 100% capture the character, but I have seen the the interview with the real character.
I think it's on Netflix right now. I'll watch it.
So it's a classic movie. I think it came, I don't know, 2004, 2005. I'm not sure around that time. It was a really well-done movie. So it's about an imposter who spent maybe 10 years. Don't quote me on that. But, you know, forging checks and pretending to be a pilot or pretending to be this or that. And this person, well-educated, he's now a security consultant for FBI. For 40 years now, he is one of the top consultants. You Google him, you're going to learn a lot from this person. And he did say, if there's anything that people us human beings, we really are innocent people. We don't like to deceive others. Mm-hmm. We act in our natural way, you know, and this is exactly what criminals take advantage of. They know that most people are good people. So we sometimes give opportunities for others. So when I was robbed during my vacation, I know I was in a non-septity place, and I thought I should be smarter. And it was in a good property. I just trusted the property, although it was in violation of septed. But I gave an opportunity. I disappeared for 1 minute, and so I have given this opportunity for someone who was watching, because I trusted people around me, and some people make use, you know, they take advantage of this trust. So what I try to say, like, if we really keep septed in mind, reduce those opportunities, then we should be fine.
Okay, good stuff. That's about a half hour. You want to wrap it up? Thank you, Linda.
You're very welcome. Okay.
Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. For more information about what we do, go to liaa.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. Talk to you guys next time.